Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Ah!
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities, many problems, many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes you may pick up a load too heavy, may get him down, may fall on top of it, but he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose, despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heart's desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendous the effect it does. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like When Nature Wants a Man by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill and she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she wets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind. When his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks. When his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned. Though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man. When nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best. When she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring. When she reins him and constrains him so his body scarce contains him. While she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest power's speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis. Lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you, everyone.
Listen again tomorrow, friends, for another message of hope with Richard Eaton. This is UBC, the United Broadcasting Company.
For some reason, this weekend, when we honor mothers, this country saw a spike in gun violence. In fact, that's where we're going to start, with some breaking news out of California for you. At least one person is dead and multiple others injured after a shooting in Hollywood. The Los Angeles Fire Department says that the victims were all adults, and those injured have been transported to area hospitals. Three are in critical condition. A motive for the shooting is unclear, at least at this moment. And this comes after a deadly Mother's Day weekend. At least 10 mass shootings happened across the country. That is according to the Gun Violence Archive. In Colorado, authorities are investigating another mass shooting less than 7 weeks after a gunman killed 10 people at a supermarket in that state. Laura Podesta is with us now from New York City. Laura, there was another incident that happened there this weekend as well in New York.
Good morning, Anne-Marie. Yes, in Times Square, police say 2 to 4 men got into a fight. One of them opened fire, shooting 3 innocent bystanders. Now, that shooter is still on the run this morning. The NYPD says they do know who he is, that he has gotten in trouble for illegal vending in the Times Square area before.
A manhunt is underway in New York after a shooting in Times Square.
All 3 are innocent bystanders.
All are expected to survive, including a 4-year-old girl, seen here being rushed to an ambulance by Officer Alyssa Vogel.
We have a male party down on the ground.
In Massachusetts, a man is dead after driving an SUV through the doors of the Leicester police station.
The man exited the vehicle and immediately shouldered what appeared to be a rifle and aimed it at the police officers. The police officers then fired and shot the man.
Police in Colorado Springs are searching for a motive after a gunman killed 6 adults at a birthday party before killing himself.
This is terrible for a lot of people in a lot of ways.
Just outside of Baltimore, cops say a 56-year-old man shot his neighbors and set fire to his own townhouse. Witnesses say it was possibly to lure people outside.
There are 3 fatal victims.
Police shot and killed the man when they arrived on scene. And in Phoenix, a shooting at a hotel left 1 dead and 7 injured.
A group of people that were attending a function inside the hotel had some sort of altercation prior to the shooting.
The rash of shootings may reignite the gun debate in Washington, which quieted down after a string of deadly shootings more than a month ago.
This has to end. It's a national embarrassment.
According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been at least 2 dozen shootings this month where 4 or more people were shot.
President Biden is expected to meet with congressional leaders on Wednesday. It's unclear if gun control will be on the agenda, but as we know, Anne Marie, President Biden has been very outspoken about ending what he calls the epidemic of gun violence in America.
He certainly has been. You gave us a whole list of shootings that have happened across the country. Do we know the motive or motives behind any of these shootings?
Well, in the Colorado Springs shooting, Anne Marie, we know that this was a targeted and an isolated attack. Police say that the gunman shot and killed his girlfriend as well as five others at the birthday party before turning the gun on himself. In Phoenix, it also appears to be an isolated incident. There were several people between the ages of 18 and 22 attending a party or a function at the Phoenix Hotel. That fight that was started at that function escalated to the point where there was the shooting. Anne Marie.
Wow. All right, Laura, thank you so much.
Now, in an hour and a half, a St. Johns County teenager accused of killing a 13-year-old girl will appear in court. Aiden Fucci is charged with second-degree murder in Tristan Bailey's death. Bailey's body was found not far from her Durban Crossing home Sunday. Good morning, everyone. Investigators have not yet said how she died.
Sheriff's Office released a statement saying it zeroed in on Fucci after the discovery of Bailey's body and remarks that he made, working to find out exactly what those remarks were. Investigators, meantime, are still searching for evidence near the home where Fucci's family lives. News 4 Jax crews were there as a dive team pulled evidence from a pond. Fucci and Bailey lived in the same neighborhood. Their homes, the pond being searched, and the amenity center where Bailey was last seen are all within a mile and a half of each other. Now, investigators say this picture showing Fucci in the back of a patrol car is part of their probe. He snapped the picture and shared it on social media with the caption, "Hey guys, has anybody, spelled I-N-B-O-D-Y, seen Tristan lately?" We are following this story from a number of different angles this morning, from the investigation to the outpouring of support for Bailey's family.
We begin with Jennifer Reddy this morning. Jen, it is not yet clear if Fucci will be charged as an adult.
Good morning. That's exactly right. The sheriff says it is still very early in this investigation and the charge or charges against the teenager could change. According to this statement from the state attorney's office, they will decide whether he will be charged as an adult.
This morning, Aiden Fucci is in custody with the Department of Juvenile Justice. The 14-year-old is charged with second-degree murder in the death of Tristan Bailey.
This is a long process we have to go through. There's multiple crime scenes involved here, as you know. And with that being said, again, we're going to let our criminal investigations division do their due diligence and take their time and get this case right.
The sheriff's office announced Fucci's arrest a little more than 24 hours after Bailey was reported missing. The sheriff's office says investigators zeroed in on him after her body was found in a wooded area, saying in part, "Based on the discovery of the body and admissions during questioning, we refocused our investigative efforts." Since then, investigators have spent hours searching Fucci's home. The sheriff's office says they found several pieces of evidence at the house after obtaining search warrants. They are also looking into any potential evidence on social media.
And Fucci will appear.
On a rainy morning in the small town of Hilton, Oklahoma, just north of the Texas border, summer school.
Penny went around eight times without stopping.
And a lesson that has nothing to do with reading or writing, but everything to do with that heavy-duty blue and white box sitting at the back of the class.
Code blue. Code blue.
To be clear, it's just a drill. There's no emergency this time. Their school is in a county where tornadoes tend to strike. The shelter is to protect against that. But by design, it's also to protect against that other ever-growing worry in all American schools, mass shootings. School Superintendent Terry Shaw heard about the shelters from an old schoolmate. He gave us a video showing how he put it to the test. That's him stepping inside, along with the Utah man who designed it, while outside, they let her rip. It worked so well, Shaw bought seven of them at $30,000 apiece. He loves them and gave us a look up close.
These are our ballistic-proof and tornado-proof storm shelters.
They're solid.
Yes.
There's room for more than 30 students, and they come complete with cameras on the outside, monitors on the inside, a ventilation system, and peace of mind for everyone.
Well, the feedback's been wonderful from parents. It's that sense of security knowing that their kids are safe at school. If that inevitable event happens where a bad guy's on campus, we've already taken care of that. We've already put in the work to help protect as many kids as possible.
Don't kid yourself. School shootings in the U.S. remain statistically rare.
Community Hope School, I think there's somebody shooting in here.
But the particular horror of young people under fire has left countless parents in this country eager for anything to ensure their kids' safety.
A lot of blood, please help.
With gun laws here deemed unlikely to change anytime soon, and with mental health issues a separate focus, American schools are fortifying themselves. The school security industry in this country is now worth some $3 billion a year. In Las Vegas, Nevada, a gathering this spring for some of the biggest players in the world of security. At the International Security Conference and Exposition, among the fastest growing sectors, schools. From facial recognition software aimed at identifying all school visitors to easy fit door stoppers, cheap and super strong, the show has it all.
Well, we call them smart safe.
Take a look at this. A biometrics protected gun safe. Teachers would need a pass card and their fingerprint to get into it for defense against a bad guy with a gun. How many biometric safes per school?
I would think, depending on the way that the school is situated, you would have maybe 3.
Like fire extinguishers?
Like a fire extinguisher, yes.
Or how about an easy way for students to unlock school doors? For that, credit this Canadian-developed software that can do it using your own cell phone.
We're trying to bring this idea of how do you use what you already have and retrofit it to increase the level of security.
Then there's this. Of course, that's not a real assault rifle, but in this demonstration, it quickly catches the eye of cameras with artificial intelligence.
See, it's picking up the weapon. The alerts are popping down there.
It's alerting like 911 or whatever.
Yes.
Where'd this idea come from?
I spent 10 years in the military as a Navy SEAL. My wife's a school teacher. And I got tired of turning on the news and seeing active shooter events almost every week. It's disgusting. And there's not a really good solution out there.
The goal? To stop school shootings before they can even begin.
All these things are in here are to mitigate threatening human behavior.
Guy Grace knows his stuff on this. He leads the group Partner Alliance for Safer Schools and is head of security for a school district in Colorado.
If nothing is done, we would have more school shootings, we would have more suicides, we would have more negative actions taking places on the campuses. So if we didn't do that, it would be tremendously a lot worse than where it is right now.
That talk gets put into action right here. It's the security control room in Grace's school district in Colorado, complete with a wall of monitors. It's the cutting edge in U.S. school security.
These are motion sensors.
Motion sensors.
Overseeing the 20 schools in this district, Grace's team has installed some 1,100 cameras throughout those schools. They can spot unusual activity automatically. His team can watch, listen in, send alerts, and with the flick of a switch, lock doors almost anywhere.
What we like about these things is if these down the road, these cameras, if somebody is carrying a weapon or something like that, that can give you an alert before they even get into the school.
If by now you're thinking it all seems a little over the top, consider there was a shooting at this school in Grace's district in 2013, leaving 2 dead, and another at this one just last month, killing 1, injuring 8. And in the district right next door, Columbine, where 20 years ago, 13 students were shot and killed.
One of the shooters ran down the hallway, and he actually pointed a gun, a sawed-off shotgun, in my direction and was shooting.
On that day in 99, Lauren Reese was a student at Columbine. Then, just 15 years old, she was between classes and on the phone with her mom when the shooting began.
And I said, Mommy, someone brought a gun to school. And all she said was, go, run. And she's like, I love you, bye.
Now with two kids of her own, she underlines this country has little choice but to strengthen its schools.
And gun laws aren't changing, and regardless if there's a law in place or not, if someone wants to get a gun, they're going to get a gun, whether it's legally or not. In a sense, you know, this is the world we live in now, but we have to protect our kids.
Still, critics say a lot of the gadgetry is driven by the security industry itself, pushing fear to make a buck. But many others counter, in today's America, fact is, you got to do something.
What about this?
And so, at another school in Guy Grace's district, where teachers' desks come equipped with hidden alarm buttons, a group of young students are on a safety refresher course.
Even if you know who they are, we don't let anybody in the building, okay?
A key part of everything, ensuring classrooms don't feel like prisons.
Next person that doesn't lock the door, go ahead.
Later, in a nearby hallway, simple drills promote muscle memory.
Push that door and lock it. Okay. Unlock it. Good job.
And for those times when a shooter threatens, rare as that might be, they emphasize...
Lockdown. Lockdown.
They learn to run and to hide wherever, however, behind anything, and quickly to stay alive. Remember, these are all elementary students.
But we're giving them something that, you know, it's maybe simple as heck or whatever, but it's giving them some confidence to make sure that they're not living in a fear.
That was not my plan.
Back in Oklahoma, where when they're not in use, those shelters double as quiet spaces for study, resignation mixes with resolve.
I hate the fact that our society is at that point, but that's where we're at. So when you're faced with a problem, I think it's our job as parents, administrators, and humans to deal with that problem. You don't want to be that school that wasn't prepared. I think we need to be that school that is moving forward in preparation to help protect our kids.
A sobering response to a challenge, say all, that now demands it. Paul Hunter, CBC News, Hilton, Oklahoma.
Mass shootings. Over the past few years, they have become as regular in America as Star Wars movies. And just like Star Wars movies, people have started paying less and less attention. But this weekend, something happened.
The nation mourns the victims of two shooting massacres just 13 hours apart. The massacres in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, happened in startling proximity for a country already too familiar with gun violence. 29 people were killed in the two shooting rampages just 13 hours apart.
Yes, in the span of 2 days, 13 hours in fact, 84 people were shot, and currently 31 people have been killed in two deadly mass shootings. And like, even though most of America has gotten used to dealing with mass shootings, having them happen back to back has forced people to take notice. In fact, this weekend's tragedy has garnered so much attention that President Trump couldn't respond with his usual sad tweet. Instead, he had to come out and give a formal address to the nation this morning where he condemned white supremacy and domestic terrorism. Unfortunately, he also offered condolences to the people of Toledo, which is not one of the cities that had a mass shooting. So that was basically the mass shooting equivalent of saying the wrong person's name in bed. But these two tragedies didn't happen in a vacuum. They're part of a rise in mass shootings in recent years. And now, news anchors, pundits, politicians alike, they're all trying to figure out the root cause of what has become a national epidemic. And they've been pinning the blame on a lot of different things, starting with the internet.
And on the controversial website 8chan, extremists seem to have found a home. At least three mass shootings this year alone have been announced on the site.
The dark corners of the internet, where these people breed hate and division.
The perils of the internet and social media cannot be ignored, and they will not be ignored. We must recognize that the internet has provided a dangerous avenue to radicalize, disturb minds, and perform demented acts.
Yes, many people, including the president, are saying that the internet is to blame for radicalizing these domestic terrorists. Because giving them a community and a platform is helping them share their ideas. It's the same way the internet has given a platform to people who eat laundry detergent, right? Yeah, back in the day, you can only share your feelings with the people at poison control. Now you have a community. So now some people are saying we need to tighten regulation of the internet. And I'll be honest with you, I'm all for it. Yeah, especially after I got catfished last week. I thought I was talking to a lonely middle-aged man who needed my social security number. Turns out it was some beautiful woman who wanted to date me. What the hell? I get what these people are saying, though. The internet is a powerful tool that can be used to radicalize wannabe mass shooters. You know, maybe that's why we don't have a mass shooting epidemic in Africa. Our internet is shit and the power keeps cutting. Yeah. Right now, there's some guy in Nigeria who's like, I want to be radicalized, but this Wi-Fi is so slow. You are so lucky this video is buffering, huh? You are so lucky. I'll just have to stick to sending emails. Dear sir, I have lost some money. Now, while some people argue that this epidemic is being caused by the internet, another argument is that it's something more precise. Because everyone uses the internet in America, but most of these shooters are young white men. And what do young white men all have in common? Video games.
The idea of these video games to dehumanize individuals, to have a game of shooting individuals and others, I've always felt that is a problem for future generations and others.
First shooter games would desensitize folks to the violence. When you see it through a screen and you don't relate to it in person, it makes it seem like it's more accessible.
What's changed in this country? We've always had guns. We've always had evil. But what's changed where we see this rash of shooting? And I see a video game industry that teaches young people to kill.
Okay. On the surface, that sounds like a pretty good argument. America has always had guns. America has always had evil. But mass shootings have only taken off over the past, 20 years? And what has been new in the past 20 years? Violent video games. Although by that logic, anything that's been invented in the last 20 years could have contributed to mass shootings. Like Crocs were invented over the last 20 years. And I know they inspire anger in me. Here's another thing though. If video games are responsible for shootings, how do you explain countries like South Korea or Japan? They play the same games at a higher rate than the U.S., but neither of these countries have a mass shooting epidemic. The worst thing Japan is dealing with right now is a karaoke epidemic. The only thing getting murdered there is Mariah Carey songs. So some people blame the internet, and others say it's video games. But for many, if the president wants to find the real cause of what's happening, he should go and look in the bathroom mirror.
The 21-year-old white male said the attack was in response to the Hispanic invasion of Texas, adding that his ideology predates President Trump and that blaming the president would be the equivalency of fake news.
This is language the president has used since his campaign began. A lot of people are taking issue with the explosive rhetoric he has used, rhetoric that mirrors the screed written by the El Paso murderer.
Just 3 months ago, this scene at a rally in Panama City Beach, Florida. President Trump at first laughing when a supporter in the crowd suggested shooting immigrants.
But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that thing.
Yeah, it might have been a joke at that rally. But clearly there are people out there who could take the president's words seriously. Now, I know it's crazy to take Trump's words seriously, but some people do. In fact, as we've learned, the mass shooter in El Paso left behind a manifesto that included the same phrases Trump uses every day. Fake news, immigrant invasions. Like, the only reason you know that it wasn't written by Trump is because the grammar was correct. And here's the thing. Although there is a chance Donald Trump has emboldened racist mass shooters, we also cannot say that he's the overall cause, because there were racist mass shooters before Donald Trump. It's the same way you can't blame stuffed crust pizzas for the obesity epidemic in America. You can't admit that adding a pizza to the edge of a pizza is not going to help people lose weight, but it's not the cause. So some people blame the internet, some say it's video games, others blame President Trump. But the thing we're hearing the most after these mass shootings is that the real cause is all in their head.
Mental health is a large contributor to any type of violence or shooting violence.
There's so many different factors you don't know. I mean, maybe a child's born with, you know, something, mental illness.
This was a sick person. The person in Dayton was a sick person. No politician is to blame for that. You cannot be a white supremacist and be normal in the head. These are sick people.
Now, again, this argument sounds completely logical. If someone kills a group of random strangers, they must be mentally ill. But that's not necessarily true. In fact, a majority of mass shooters have no history of mental illness, which is a scary thought, because it means most mass shooters are killing because they want to, not because something went wrong in their brain. So what causes mass shootings? Is it the internet? Is it video games? Is it Trump? Is it mental illness? You know what's sad and frustrating about America is that after every mass shooting, lawmakers want to identify the one thing that causes all mass shootings. And if they can't agree on what that thing is, nothing gets done. But the truth is, when it comes to any individual shooting, the cause could be any one of those factors, if not more. But there's one thing that every mass shooting has in common. Whatever motivated it has to be combined with a gun.
Weekend violence in Chicago claimed 7 lives and injured dozens more.
The surge in the city coincided with that warmer weather. WGN's Sean Lewis live at Chicago Police Headquarters with the latest. Hi, Sean.
Hi there to both of you. You'll hear this time and time again, Chicago Police officially telling us that weather and violence do not correlate in the city of Chicago, though if you look at the numbers, especially this weekend, it tells a different story. The warm weekend weather brought with it a flurry of violence. Across Chicago, gunfire and knife attacks cut short the lives of at least 7 people and injured at least another 46. One of the latest near the United Center at Adams and Seeley. Chicago police working into the early morning hours on Monday. 5 people, all between 20 and 32 years old, were shot as they stood outside. One of them rushed to the hospital in critical condition. This shooting happened just after 11 p.m. Sunday. Police believe the gunshots came from a gray Audi SUV with 3 people inside. On Sunday afternoon, just before 3 o'clock, 2 men were shot here in the 800 block of North Ridgeway. A 40-year-old man survived, but the 34-year-old man was pronounced dead at Mount Sinai Hospital. That shooting, about the same time and less than 2 miles from where a 17-year-old boy was shot in the face and killed as he drove in the 4800 block of West Ferdinand. And early Saturday morning, a 35-year-old man was found stabbed in the neck and chest here in the 2600 block of South Christiana. While Area 4 detectives are investigating, no one is yet in custody. Our Chicago police did make one arrest in a different stabbing, that one happening early yesterday morning on Harrison. They saw 2 men fighting as they were on patrol. As they pulled up, one man started to run away. They noticed the other man was on the ground. They took the other man in custody. Unfortunately, the man who was on the ground had been stabbed to death. We are live at CPD headquarters. Sean Lewis, WGN News.
Keep going. Run out that way. Keep going.
Run. That's the first rule when faced with an active gunman.
Keep going.
And if you cannot run, then you try to hide. This shopper cannot see what's happening, but they can hear the shots.
I know.
Outside, the devastation of the attack is everywhere. There are dead bodies scattered across this car park, and you can hear the distress from those who've had to find them. These shoppers in El Paso are trapped in fear of their lives, but here, armed officers have entered with their guns trained. And those hiding can now escape.
Like 3,000
people came to this shopping center during the busy back-to-school season. 20 of them were murdered. in the first of two U.S. mass shootings in under 24 hours, and the third in the last week. This image taken from CCTV reportedly shows the suspect. He has been named locally as 21-year-old Patrick Crucius. The man is currently in police custody, but this attack is more than a mass shooting. It's a domestic terror investigation.
Right now we have a manifesto from this individual that indicates to some degree it has a nexus to potential hate crime.
El Paso was on the much politicized U.S. border with Mexico. It is overwhelmingly Hispanic. Ahead of the shooting, a manifesto which appears to be linked to the attack was posted online. It warned that white Americans should fear other races and suggested a return to segregation. It also used racist language and cited the so-called Hispanic invasion of Texas. El Paso is also the hometown of the man hoping to win the Democratic nomination for president, and he did not hold back on where he lay blame.
The president's language, his rhetoric, has produced the kinds of hate crimes that we saw in El Paso yesterday, but we've been seeing across this country. They've been on the rise for each one of the last 3 years. So we cannot act as though this were just some kind of natural disaster or a matter of course for this country or the new normal for the United States. There is a very real cause to this, and President Trump is part of that.
But on Twitter, President Trump called the shooting tragic, an act of cowardice, and a hateful act. And today he tweeted about those affected by the mass shootings in Texas and Ohio. He asked God to bless both communities. Nine people have been confirmed dead in the Ohio mass shooting this morning. The gunman was named as 24-year-old Connor Betts. He was shot dead by officers, and police say most of his victims were black. But today's news is part of an intensifying American tragedy, and as yet, this nation's tradition of gun violence shows no sign of ending.
Well, in the last few moments, the authorities in Ohio say the 22-year-old sister of the suspect there is one of the nine people killed. Earlier, I spoke to the El Paso author, Richard Parker, who witnessed the aftermath of the Texas shooting. I started by asking him how the Hispanic community was reacting to this awful tragedy.
Well, El Paso, on the American side alone, is an overwhelmingly Hispanic city. I myself grew up here. I'm a native of El Paso, and I am of Mexican descent myself. And so, you know, almost 90% of the population here is Hispanic, just on the U.S. side of the border. Like any mass shooting in the United States, what we have seen is the city kind of shut down. People react in fear, frankly. The streets were empty yesterday afternoon and well into the evening. Restaurants, bars that are generally quite popular or busy on a Saturday night simply closed. And it was really out of not a sense of trepidation about another shooting, but because of the shock, frankly, and in mourning for the people who were lost.
It's reported that the alleged killer put out a kind of manifesto online talking of a Hispanic invasion. How do you react to such language? What do you make of it?
To be entirely blunt with you, the language of the manifesto could just as well have been written by the White House press office. These are the kinds of lines, almost verbatim, that appear in the speeches and talks of the President of the United States, President Donald Trump. That was the thing that jumped out at me most. There is a very strong and, in my view, inextricable link between the events of yesterday and the sort of 3 years of targeting Latinos in this country, not merely immigrants, but Hispanics, whether they are citizens, legal residents, or none of the above.
That is an incendiary claim you make about Donald Trump. I mean, I'm sure he would say the responsibility for these awful killings rests with the gunman alone. What connection can you realistically make between the rhetoric of many politicians, including the president, and this hateful violence that we're seeing?
It's really quite simple. If you read the manifesto, which is not yet confirmed by the authorities, I would concede, it's crystal clear, and in fact the gunman writes this, that his hope in killing Hispanics is not simply about killing immigrants, but in fact about driving Hispanics out of the United States. Now, it has been done in small episodes before in our past, over 100 years ago, right here in Texas. But this is the most targeted and most lethal attack on Latino Americans in the United States in our nation's history.
How on earth do you erase those bitter divisions, you know, that you're seeing emerging in the political rhetoric? How do you build bridges in this case?
Well, to be quite candid, we have two problems. We have a Trump problem, admittedly, but we also have a gun problem in America. I'm a Texan, I own guns, and I'm a hunter. And I have no problem with those kinds of weapons. We have 300 million guns. We have almost as many guns as we have people. Until we can put a cap and begin to reduce the number of those military-grade weapons that are for sale, we will continue to endure this. And that is not the president's fault by any means. However, we also have a Trump problem, frankly. He has incited hatred towards Muslims, towards African Americans, and in this case with great lethality towards Latino Americans too.
Richard Parker, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
In 1999, students Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold would embark on a massacre that would make history.
People are getting shot all around me.
And the name of one Colorado high school synonymous with tragedy.
Children were running from the school at breakneck speeds, and I knew that the world had changed.
As the clock ticked,
that guy is in a black trench coat. Turn your front door.
The body count rose.
They would pop underneath a table, they would say something like peekaboo, and they would shoot someone.
And with it the question, why have these two young men waged war on their classmates and teachers?
A bullet entered the side of my backpack, spun around and actually shot me in the back.
And committed the world's most notorious killing spree.
What caused them to have so much hatred they were willing to walk in and kill as many people as possible?
In 1999, the area of Columbine, on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, had been the epitome of ordinary.
It's a suburban area. It's pretty quiet, not a lot of crime. It's overwhelmingly white, middle class, which is to say a very homogeneous place.
But one spring day in 1999 would bring the unremarkable neighborhood worldwide notoriety.
You know, April 20th of 99 was a typical day. I was eager to get my grades bumped up because I was 15 at the time, so getting a driver's permit was definitely on the horizon.
The morning definitely was just a regular day. Starting my shift, I was an emergency response specialist. I just took regular phone calls to the sheriff's office, as well as a 911 phone call.
Normal day, we had ran a couple, you know, basic calls, medical calls.
It was just like any other day. Went off to work. I was leaving that day for a conference in another part of our state.
Tom's 15-year-old son made his way to Columbine High School.
Daniel was a very shy kid. Very shy, very reserved, very sweet, a very lovable kid. He was someone who, even as a teenager, was not ashamed to give his mom a big hug.
For fellow students, 16-year-old Craig Scott and his 17-year-old sister Rachel, the morning had not started harmoniously.
My sister was in the car. She was honking her horn because I was making us late. And I had to have my hair just perfect. And we got into the car together, and she was kind of getting on to me about being late, and we got into an argument. This is the road that Rachel and I were on together to go to school, and Rachel would pull into here to drop me off. She was just asking me not to make us late all the time, and so we were kind of back and forth in an argument, and we pulled up to this school, and I got out of the car, and I turned and I looked at her, and I slammed the car door shut. And I walked into school. I had no idea that'd be the last time that I'd see Rachel alive.
Around 11:19 a.m., Columbine School, West Entrance. Sean Graves and his friend's world was about to change forever.
For lunch, there was three of us that day that chose not to eat. Dan Robaugh, Lance Kirkland, and myself. We stepped out the side door like we typically would. We'd usually grab a soda at the vending machines right there, and we'd just jet up and take the path off. Only that morning, things were a little different. We were looking up at the top of the dirt hill, and we saw two guys that were wearing all black, their black trench coats, and with them they were carrying a couple of black duffel bags. We witnessed them loading weapons that we just assumed were toys, and that's when it started. They showered us with rounds, and Dan and Lance both went down.
One floor above, in the library, Craig and his friend Matt were sitting revising.
You know, we thought that we were hearing fireworks.
We saw students running away from the school.
They were trekking through the soccer field. You know, we thought that, you know, it was a senior prank. It's about that time for the end of the year for some silly prank to happen. It was a tradition.
But this was no prank. A nightmare that would shock the world had just begun. At approximately 11:19 a.m. on the 20th of April 1999, a deadly killing spree had begun at Columbine High School in Colorado. Outside the school cafeteria, 15-year-old student Sean Graves and his friends Dan and Lance were being fired on by two teenagers dressed in black trench coats.
My body was completely behind a concrete wall, so I was protected. The only thing on me that was sticking past that was my backpack. A bullet entered the side of my backpack, spun around, and actually shot me in the back and shot out my right hip. And at that moment, I lost my legs completely. I was paralyzed from the waist down immediately.
What Sean had originally thought was a prank was far from it.
I found myself laying halfway in the school and halfway out, and at that moment I knew that my worst nightmare had come true. Months, possibly years before the shooting actually took place, I had a reoccurring nightmare of somebody in my family or even myself being paralyzed. It didn't make any sense then, but the second I looked back at my legs, I realized that that dream had come true. And I was the one that was going to be paralyzed.
Sean lay in the doorway of the cafeteria. And for hundreds of students inside, the reality of what was happening was beginning to sink in.
All I remember from that moment was just the fear in their eyes looking at me, and I'm sure I had fear looking back. And that's when the fire alarm went off and the cafeteria started to evacuate.
Okay. A guy is in a black trench coat. There's a guy. They just shot somebody inside the cafeteria. I'm going to have to try.
Over the prior year, the two mystery shooters had made several extraordinary videos. Both spoof and serious, that were chillingly similar to the spree to come. The violent, merciless attacks played out in the videos had now become a reality.
The two shooters walked down to try and finish off everyone, and I watched one of the shooters shoot Lance in the face.
At Jefferson County Sheriff's Department, Detective Kate Batten was just returning from an early lunch.
I asked what was going on. They said that there was a shooting at Columbine High School. So at that point, I started driving towards Columbine. And that's when it became surreal, because the dispatcher was talking about snipers on the roof. They were talking about bombs exploding. And I'm just astounded that this is information that's being relayed in suburban Littleton.
My secretary ran in, the door was shut, and she said, there's been a report of shootings or of gunfire and bombs exploding. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about? I came out of my office and I ran down here, and as I looked down the corridor, I saw a gunman coming towards me with the shotgun. When I was staring down and I made contact, it seemed like the size of a cannon. All I kept thinking is what it was going to feel like to be shot. You know, I thought of my family. Was I going to die quickly? Each time a bullet was fired from the gun, then glass would shatter behind me. I hear bullets exploding in that area. And what really probably saved my life is girls coming out of the gymnasium in this crossing hall. They were coming into the crossfire, and I wanted to make sure that they were not hit by the gunman's gunfire. I ran down to this hallway, and I was able to get the girls into the gymnasium area.
Emergency.
Well, we just got a frantic call from my daughter saying he's chasing us with a gun, and then she hung up the phone, and you could hear the screaming in the hallway.
Yeah.
6 weeks earlier, March the 16th, 1999, in the mountains south of Columbine. The two shooters recorded another video. This time, the weapons were real.
That's a slug.
Imagine that in someone's brain.
Both were students at Columbine High School, just weeks away from graduating.
Oh. Entry, exit.
17-year-old Dylan Klebold. And 18-year-old Eric Harris.
No, no, no.
Harris was a young man that was in advanced classes. You know, he had dreams of going to the military. He applied or to enlist in the Marines. Klebold was a kid who a few weeks prior had visited one of the state universities in Arizona, so his plan was to go to college. Klebold was at prom 3 nights prior.
Now both Harris and Klebold seemed intent on the destruction of the school and everyone in it. By 11:27 a.m., the two shooters were in an area near the library, where Craig Scott and numerous fellow students were working.
We're hearing the firecrackers. We're thinking that it's a prank. We're laughing, we're joking about it. And then that's when a teacher ran into the room. She ran over to the phone. She got on the phone to call the police.
Jefferson County 911.
The phone rings, and you know, I had a caller on the other end of the line who stated that something was happening at Columbine High School.
There is a student here with a gun. He has shot out a window.
There was children in the library, and she wanted to, obviously, you know, protect them and take care of them.
Hands on the table, kid! Hands under the table!
She saw the shots happen. She knew this was serious. She knew this was real.
Okay. We've got help on the way, ma'am. Okay. Oh, God.
Stay in the line with me.
Oh, God.
I got underneath the table with my buddy Matt, and then my friend Isaiah, he came and he sat next to me.
Still lying paralyzed in the cafeteria doorway, 15-year-old Sean could do nothing but listen.
I can hear explosions going off upstairs, and I can hear people screaming, and I can hear gunshots just echoing throughout the school, and there's just chaos everywhere.
We have paramedics, we have fire, and we have police en route.
We were just setting down to lunch, and the tones went off for a reported possible drive-by shooting near Columbine High School. My partner and I jumped into the medic unit and started heading towards Columbine. As we pulled up, several students running by, and one young gal had a bullet hole in her, I believe, right calf. We treated her.
After several minutes shooting and throwing homemade bombs in the corridor outside, Harrison Klebold now approached the library entrance, where the teacher was under the desk, on the line to 911 dispatch.
I remember trying to get her to close the doors and lock them, to keep everyone in.
Is there any way you can block the door so no one can get in?
I do not. She's right outside that door. I'm afraid to go to the door.
It's okay.
It was trying to keep her calm so that I could, you know, figure out what was going on.
I'll rip off your goddamn head!
Dylan was a family friend of our kids for a long time. He grew up here, sort of.
Dylan was here a lot. The kids met each other in the first grade and became best friends.
Hey, what's going on, dude? This is Dylan.
There were never fights. A lot of kids you have to send home after a while because, you know, it gets with boys. It was great. The three of them got along great.
He was a nice, gentle young man.
Dylan Klebold was born in Colorado, and at the time of the shooting was living in his parents' designer home in a desirable natural area just outside the town.
Dylan's parents, they were intellectuals and artists at heart. They had met at Ohio State University in the art program.
They didn't believe in spanking. They didn't believe in guns. They didn't believe in war. They were pacifists.
Eric Harris's background was also far from underprivileged.
Eric's father was ex-military. He was a decorated Air Force test pilot.
It required them to bounce around a bit from city to city as his father would get transferred, but lived in normal middle-class neighborhoods, not living in the inner city and subject to gangs or drugs or violence. It did affect Eric, however, always having to move to another school, make new friends again. That was tough for him.
Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold were both deeply into computers, and both complained they were victims of bullying by sporty students known as jocks. After settling in the Columbine area, Harris became friends with Klebold, and as such also hung out with Dylan's friend Brooks Brown. But it would not always be a smooth relationship.
He had thrown a snowball at Brooks's car and cracked the windshield. And a kid came up and said, here's Eric's backpack. I took it while he was throwing the snowballs. So I'm thinking, well, what's this? I'm going to take the backpack back. So we drove down in the car, and I rolled down the window, and I said to Eric, I've got your backpack. Meet me at your mom's house. And we rolled back up the window. Well, he started banging on the window crazy, saying, give me my backpack. He was frantic. That was the first time I saw that anger. And it was very unusual. It was quick, and it was fast, and it was unrelenting.
I will freaking kill you. I'm going to pull out a goddamn shotgun.
The 20th of April, 1999. 11:29 a.m. Columbine High School, Western Side. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold entered the library, where four staff members and 52 students were hiding.
As soon as they came in, they were shooting off their guns. They began to yell at students. They were making some mocking comments.
Nobody, whatever their race, sex, or social status, would be safe from the killing spree.
The first person that they killed was Kyle Velasquez, who didn't know to hide. He had a disability, and he liked simple things. His family said he liked panda bears, he liked coloring, and they became the bully.
What would happen next in that library would horrify the world. Throughout 1998 and early 99, Columbine High School students, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, had made a number of home videos themed around violence. On April the 20th, just weeks before they were both due to graduate, fantasy became reality. At 11:29 a.m., they entered the library. Like his fellow students, 16-year-old Craig Scott was hiding under a table with his friends Matt and Isaiah.
A lot of students were being quiet. Some girls were crying, and some girls were begging for their life.
911 dispatcher Rene Napoli was listening in to a phone line left open at the library desk.
I could hear them speaking, as well as the children in the library, and there was the definite sound of gunshots.
They actually fired out the windows at the police officers, and two of those police officers, or deputy sheriffs, fired back. They then walked over and they started systematically shooting the kids.
They treated it like it was a game, like they were having fun. At one point, they would pop underneath a table, they would say something like peekaboo, and they would shoot someone.
I think that they were enjoying themselves through a good portion of the shooting. There was a lot of hooting and hollering and false bravado between the two of them.
Three would be shot dead and four injured before Harris and Klebold worked their way towards Craig Scott.
They came over to where I was and they saw Isaiah. And Isaiah was one of the very few African-American students in our school. And I believe Dylan called Eric over and using a racial slur. We have an N-word over here. At one point, he was kind of backing up underneath the table. And then at one point he was being pulled out. And this is something that came up in my memory later. I remember Isaiah said, "I want to see my mom." They shot Isaiah, and then they turned their gun towards Matt, and they shot Matt. I had decided to pretend to be dead and not draw any attention to myself. And so I laid there and I could hear their last breaths being taken.
Five more students would lose their lives, leaving 10 dead and 12 injured in the deadly library spree, before Harris and Klebold left the room at 11:36 a.m. and began wreaking further havoc around the school.
Sheriff's Office, do you have an emergency?
Yes, we do. Can you guys send lots and lots of paramedics?
We have paramedics, we have fire, and we have police on route.
SWAT sniper Sean Duggan was one of several law enforcement officers with children at the school.
I got a page, and it said, all SWAT respond to a critical incident. So I have all my gear, and I'm trying to call my daughter, and she's not answering her page, and she was a senior in the school that day. So I'm a little frantic that she's not responding.
Hundreds of emergency personnel were flocking to the school.
There was ambulances and fire trucks and police cars and sheriff's cars parked everywhere. And children were running from the school at breakneck speeds as fast as they could.
I was running for my life. And when I got behind the police car,
I couldn't help but be thinking about Matt and Isaiah, because there was still a little bit of breathing, and I felt a little like a coward.
I was under a table, and people were getting shot all around me.
It was overwhelming to see the emotion on these kids' faces, and I knew that the world had changed.
And there's so many people. Oh, my God.
Everybody was calling 911 from inside the school, from outside the school, so the information that we were getting was conflicting.
As a sniper, you ask what your rules of engagement are. Is this a deadly force situation? And I was told if any high school age kids come out in black trench coats with weapons, they were to be shot.
Amongst the confusion, the name of one suspect began to trickle out.
I spoke to Brooke Brown, who's a student. Okay. He's given me good suspect information. I think this is the guy.
Okay, what do you got for a name?
Okay. Last name is Harris. He was friends with him approximately 2 years ago, but then he started acting really strange.
Okay.
It would be revealed that Eric Harris's behavior had already been seriously worrying some people.
Along the way, Eric did let out a different lot of signs. He had on his website talking about how we wanted to kill all sorts of people. Hundreds of people wanted to kill everybody in Denver. And in particular, Brooks Brown, his former friend.
Disputes like the incident with the broken windshield had put Brown on Harris's hit list.
Brooks was supposed to pick Eric up for school, and Brooks was terrible with being on time, and Brooks slept in and didn't pick him up, and that was it. That was it. And I said to Brooks, can you smooth it over? And Brooks said, it doesn't work that way with Eric. And so that was the indication Eric doesn't forgive. He was an injustice collector.
Dylan, who was still friends with and had been lifelong friends with Brooks, warned Brooks to go to a website and see what was going on.
He was posting threats about wanting to kill Brooks, and that's the thing we took to the police. And from when he started making the death threats, he wasn't allowed in our house anymore. We knew that Eric was dangerous. We did not know Dylan.
When we turned him into the police, Eric was into pipe bombs, and he was talking about it on his website.
It was actually a search warrant drawn up, but then was never taken before a judge to search Eric's house. That was never followed up on because there was another series of murders in the town where the person investigating sort of went off that case for a while and never picked it up again.
Dex!
But Harris and Klebold's plan involved something much worse than homemade pipe bomb grenades. As Sean Graves, still paralyzed and bleeding half inside the cafeteria door, was about to experience.
I started hearing the gunshots getting closer, and that's when I realized that they were coming down the stairs in the cafeteria. They just kept getting closer and closer and closer, and I started hearing explosions. But every time there was a shot, and then one of those larger booms went off, I flinched.
Harris and Klebold's killing spree had not just been planned as a shooting. Before they had opened fire that morning, they had placed two large explosive devices in the canteen. They had been timed to explode at 11:17 a.m., and the two students had planned to wait outside to pick off any survivors fleeing the scene.
Eric Harris had even gone so far as to study how many people were in the cafeteria at any given time during the lunch hour. So he set those bombs to go off when he would have the mass casualty. Approximately 450 is what he was estimating, and we had 455 kids down there.
The bombs' timers had not worked, which is why Harris and Klebold had begun their killing spree with their guns. However, they'd not given up on their dream of blowing up the school.
Well, I didn't know it at the time. There was actually a propane canister bomb, essentially, that was no more than 5 feet from where I was laying. And they were shooting at it, trying to get the bomb to go off.
Their new attempts to detonate the bombs only succeeded in a relatively small partial explosion and fire. but they were a sign of a highly planned, premeditated suicide mission.
These two students did not just snap. In this case, it was clear they began talking about doing something like this just about a little over a year before. Eric Harris's first entry in his journal, in his notebook, is April 10th, 1998. The first words I read, I think, kind of set the tone, and it was, I hate the effing world.
You know, he's not talking about hating jocks. He's not talking about, you know, any kind of particular group. Later, he makes fun of just about everybody. People who drive too slow in the fast lane, people who say across instead of across, or, you know, mispronounce words, you know. Any trivial thing, you know, there's nothing too trivial for Eric to have contempt for you.
Dylan also had a lot of writings and notes that he left. His centered around his emotions, his feelings. He clearly stated he was depressed. He clearly stated that his life was a mess.
Dylan's journal went on for 2 years, and the very first page, he talks about killing himself. He had a miserable perception of himself, and often at complete odds with reality.
He was, in my mind, a classic adolescent depressive, or going through an adolescent depressive episode. When confronted with some of his inappropriate behavior, he would get extremely angry, whereas when people confronted Eric with some of his earlier misbehaviors, he would respond in a classic psychopathic way. He would tell you what you wanted to hear, promise never to do it again, and would be looking you in the eyes and deliberately telling you what he thought you wanted to hear.
Harris had a personality disorder that made him lacking in empathy for the suffering of victims, made him very manipulative and crafty. You know, he had an uncanny ability to present himself any way he wanted, so he looked like a good guy to many people. But actually, he didn't have a conscience, or what Sigmund Freud called a superego.
Brooks Brown's mother experienced Eric's excuses when his father sent him around to apologize for damaging her son's windscreen.
He looked at me and he said, Mrs. Brown, I'm sorry, I didn't mean any harm. And I said, look, Eric, you can pull the wool over everyone's eyes, but you're not going to do it over mine. You come by this house, you threaten my kid, you do damage, I'm going to call the police. So you stay away from our house and stay away from me. And he said, are you calling me a liar? And I said, yes, I am. And don't come around the house again. And he got bright red. I mean, he was so angry at me, and he left the house.
Together, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold had become a deadly partnership. And the two killers were now wreaking havoc, not only inside the school, but outside too, as parents feared for the fate of their children.
About the time I got to my sniper position, my phone rang, and it was my daughter. And I said, are you okay? She says, yeah, I'm home. And I said, okay, I have to go. I love you. And we hung up.
Many parents, including Daniel Mauser's father, learned of the unfolding events through the media.
There on the television was news coverage. It looked terrible. But I said to myself, well, if there's something going wrong at the school, certainly my son wouldn't be involved. He was not somebody who'd be in trouble or being targeted by somebody.
When I got home, my wife had a very concerned look on her face. Why wasn't he calling us?
So I agreed to go to another school where a number of the students were being taken in school buses after they escaped.
And as I was driving, I was listening to the news coverage. And at one point, I heard them mention that they were taking some students to the hospital. And one of the ones they mentioned was a 15-year-old boy who was shot. So of course, the first thing I thought was, 15 years old, that's how old Daniel is. What if that's Daniel? Could that be my son?
At the nearby elementary school, many parents would be reunited with their traumatized kids.
I saw parents walking out with children. And I just said to myself, I want to be one of them. I want to get this over with. I want to be one of those people.
By 12.02 p.m., Columbine High School, cafeteria exit, student Sean Graves, bleeding profusely, had passed out. Meanwhile, two medic units approached his location.
I drove around the south side as we're pulling into the parking lot through all the cars, see several students hiding behind cars, several deputies with their weapons trained on the building.
I couldn't figure out what woke me up, but when I did snap back to it, there was some commotion behind me, and as I overlooked my shoulder, there was an ambulance sitting right behind me. I saw two paramedics. One jumped out of the driver's seat and the other from the back of the ambulance, and they grabbed me, picked me up by my shirt and my belt, and they were dragging me out. And I remember just looking down to see my arms and my legs dangling. And that's when the shooters realized that somebody was down there helping us. And I could see the concrete, just poofs of white dust. They were opening fire on us. They were trying to kill us again.
Holed up amongst the dead and injured in the library, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold now had their weapons trained on the paramedics and casualties below. By 12.02 p.m., on the 20th of April 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold had been running amok in Columbine High School for more than 40 minutes, leaving a trail of dead and injured in their wake. Then, as fire department paramedics moved in to assist casualties, like Sean Graves and his friends, Harris and Klebold began firing on the kids and rescuers.
I found Medic 13's crew were struggling to get Sean Graves loaded up into the medic unit. So I came up in the middle of him, and one had the head, the other had the feet, and we stepped into the ambulance.
They threw me in first.
Saw another young man laying by the fence, and he turned his head and made eye contact with me and said, "Help me." I scooped up and dumped the young man literally into the back of the ambulance so that they could get out of the gunfire.
I just remember hearing the sounds of bullets hitting the top of the ambulance, just the metal tinging. And that's, I'll take that away from all of that as being a sound that I'll never forget.
It would be among the last acts of Harrison Klebold's killing spree.
They were shooting at the cops, they were taking pot shots, and police were firing back. I think they realized the only escape was going to be into the long arm of the law and a prosecution and jail and prison. And I think there was a thought of, let's end this the way we want it to end. Let's control our own destiny.
At around 12.08 p.m., Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold took their own lives. But for the children of Columbine High School and their parents, the nightmare was far from over.
Kids would leave Columbine and they would be placed on a bus and reunified with their parents. And as the night went on, buses were not arriving and there were still parents left.
After nothing happening for a while, they informed us that there was one last school bus that was coming. One last school bus with students.
But for some desperate parents, clinging on to the hope that their children would return, there was to be no happy ending.
Later on, the authorities confirmed to us that they made a terrible mistake. There was no last school bus.
At the end of the day, we had 13 innocent people killed, which were 12 students and one teacher. In addition, Harrison Klebold also dead by apparent suicide in the library. So we knew we had 15 fatalities, most of the fatalities in the library.
For Craig Scott, who had suffered the trauma of having his friends murdered beside him in the library, there was worse to come when he learned of the fate of his sister.
Rachel was the first one that was killed, and she had been killed right outside the school library. And I realized that when I ran out of the school, I had ran right by Rachel. And
my son was one of the last that was shot. He was next to last who was shot. And from the reports that we have, Eric Harris looked at Daniel and insulted him. I believe it was he called him Four Eyes because he wore glasses. And he fired a shot that went into Daniel's hand. Daniel fought back. He took the chair that was there and he pushed it towards Eric Harris. And for that, he paid with his life. Eric Harris fired one more time and shot him in the face. Killed him.
So what caused these two students, both just weeks away from graduating, to have such disdain for human life?
These two kids did not come out of their mother's womb hating. What happened from the time they were born to the time that they carried out this horrific act?
One thing that is erroneous is to talk about why they did this, implying that it was for the same reasons. They were two basically different guys. In my colloquialisms, I would say Eric Harris was filled with anger, with rage. He wanted to hurt other people and didn't care if he died. Dylan, on the other hand, I believe was hurting inside and at various times wanted to die because he felt so bad he just saw no reason to keep on living.
People who study these call them dyads, and you know, there's a long history of Bonnie and Clyde, Leopold and Loeb. And very often, most often, you have a stronger person and a weaker person. In this case, Dylan had incredibly low self-esteem, needed somebody to validate him, make him feel good about himself.
Some consider bullying at the school to be the primary factor.
Once you hate the bullies and no one does anything to defend you, you hate the people in the class that don't say anything. You hate the teacher that doesn't say anything. You hate the counselors that allow it to happen. They, in essence, end up hating the school, not just the bullies. They hate the school, and they want to kill the school.
I think that they didn't see that they had a lot going for them. They became isolated, and that isolation and then exposure to a lot of negative influences in their life that they chose to focus on, I think really took them towards a darker and darker place.
Harris was the dominant person who inspired the Columbine massacre, and I think Klebo went along to get along. It was that chemistry that created this insane circumstance where they were able to kill lots of people with moral impunity.
For the Columbine teachers, students, and parents, life would never be the same again.
I was paralyzed from the waist down. I spent months in the hospital. They didn't foresee me ever walking again. And I was angry. I was very angry about that. But at the same time, I'm extremely stubborn. So I didn't let that be the end of it. I made a goal for myself to walk across the stage at graduation. I wanted to be able to graduate knowing that I didn't let those two control my life. I didn't let them ruin my life. And I've actually been walking ever since.
For 911 dispatcher René Napoli, who listened as 10 children were murdered in the library, the enormity of what she'd heard soon hit home.
My first day off, I went to pick up my children from high school, and I had a had a really hard time picking up my own children from high school. So much so that my son had to drive home. And that's when it really hit me, is that I'm able to pick up my children from high school and somebody else is not able to do that.
The words that we have here were written by my wife. She did a great job of summing up Daniel's life and what this means to us to have this here to honor him. Wow.
It's like they did it for Daniel.